Welcome to Mysteries, Monsters, and Mayhem.
I'm Shannon Lawrence.
And I'm MB Partlow.
Quick content warning before we get started. This podcast may contain language and disturbing content, so enter at your own risk. Okay, well, hello. We are here today with Megan Rutter. So, Megan, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us your job background. Tell us about your book.
Okay, hi. I'm Megan Rutter. I write under the pen name MR Rutter. I was a grad student years ago. I finished my master's degree and was working on my PhD when I decided to jump out of academia in forensic anthropology. And so I worked professionally in the field as an assistant to my advisor. So everybody says, oh, so you were Bones. And I'm like, no, I was more like Zach, minus the whole cannibalism thing. And yeah, I'm not particularly fond of using that reference, but that's the best I can explain because I'm also not particularly fond of using TV to explain forensics.
Right.
So I stopped working in the field in about 2006 or 2007. It would have been the end of 2006, beginning of 2007, after my daughter was born with a genetic condition. And when you become a parent, it gets harder and harder to put dead children back together.
Yeah.
So that's when I moved into writing. And I write dark romantic suspense that still uses my forensics background. But at least all my bad guys get caught in the end.
I like that.
Are you working on a new book?
I am. So Dangerous Ground actually came out 4.5 years ago. And then my daughter's condition worsened. And I actually am just now finishing all the back material and blurb for its sequel, finally, Plain Murder.
That's great, though. Yeah.
The longest spread between the novel and the sequel.
Listen, have you heard of George R. R. Martin?
That's exactly who I was thinking of.
That is true. I have not reached George R. R. Martin levels yet.
Yeah, he's given us all a stretch limitation there.
Is it Patrick Rothfuss?
Yeah, probably.
Who wrote that big fantasy novel? There's two of them. It's a trilogy, but only two are out. And they're the size of, you know, a giant encyclopedia. I read them. I loved them. But I'm like, how freaking long do I have to wait for the third one?
I don't think the third ever came out.
Uh-uh.
Did it?
Not yet.
I don't know. I mean, David Eddings was the same way. I don't know if you remember him. He's kind of popular in the 80s, but there was quite the wait. And then there's Ken Follett. You know, he wrote his Cathedral trilogy over the course of like 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, see, you're fine. You're doing
it. Not that bad. Not that bad yet.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, we're going to jump in. I guess I'm going to warn our listeners that at least two of the cases deal with kind of somewhat brutal subject involving children. So, you've got your trigger warning there. And they all have children involved in some way or another. So I'm going to go first. All right. I'm doing the Fatal Vision murders. And my sources are Wikipedia, the Jeffrey McDonald case.com, which gives you away the person's name right there, and Grunge. There was a ton of recent stuff, which I'll go into later why, but it was all saying the same thing. So, all right. February 17th. 1970, military police on Fort Bragg in North Carolina received an emergency phone call from Jeffrey McDonald. The house was locked up and dark when they arrived, but the back door was wide open. The MPs found two of the tenants in the master bedroom. Colette McDonald was on her back, one breast exposed, one eye open. She had been brutalized with 21 stab wounds from ice pick in her chest and 16 stabs to her chest and neck with a knife. Her forearms were broken, likely defensive wounds, and her trachea severed from those stab wounds. Her husband, Jeffrey McDonald, was lying beside her, as was a paring knife. He had his head on her chest and an arm wrapped around her. He pleaded with the MPs to check his children, saying he'd heard them crying. On the headboard of the bed in their room, Colette's blood, according to later testing, had been used to write pig. So right there, I'm going to say, does this sound familiar to anybody? Like a theme here, pig written in blood. Okay. The children were 5-year-old Kimberly and 2-year-old Kristen. They were both found in their own beds, Kristen with a bottle lying beside her. They had been viciously stabbed and bludgeoned in the face and head. Kimberly had 8 to 10 stab wounds in her face, but it was the bludgeoning that caused her death. Kristen, the baby, had a total of 48 stab wounds in the chest, back, hands, and neck with both an ice pick and a knife. The stab wounds to her hands were thought to be defensive wounds. Jeffrey McDonald was resuscitated and was quoted as saying, "Jesus Christ, look at my wife. I'm going to kill those goddamned acid heads." Which just, this is all going to add up. Sounds kind of ridiculous. He was rushed to Womack Hospital, where he was found to have minor cuts and scratches, plus fingernail wounds on the face and chest. He had a single stab wound between 2 ribs that had collapsed his lung, plus a mild concussion. In short, his wounds were nothing at all compared to the wounds of his wife and his babies. He stayed in the hospital for 9 days recovering. Funnily enough, he would continue to add wounds in future retellings, ultimately claiming stab wounds in his abdomen and chest that doctors would deny on the stand had ever existed. So it went from those few to like, yeah, I had 10 ice pick stab wounds in my abdomen, and I was stabbed in my chest and my bicep, and I had this and that. Oh God. No. CID, which is the Criminal Investigation Division, questioned him, and he claimed that at 2 a.m. he'd gone to bed, finding that Kristen was on his side and had wet the bed. He said he put her in her own bed and took some blankets to sleep on the couch because he didn't want to wake up his wife to make the, you know, change the sheets. Screams woke him up. Confused, he stood from the couch to go toward the screams, but there were 3 men there, 2 white and 1 black. They were clearly hippies. The men attacked him with a club and an ice pick, while a 4th invader, a woman with long blonde hair and a white floppy hat and white tall boots, chanted while holding a candle, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs." I mean, the thing is, the first time I heard this story, I'm just going to have an aside here. The first time I heard this story on a show, I went, well, this dude clearly did it. This is clearly a military dude trying to say what hippies would do and sound like.
Because if you're going out to run rampant and kill people, what do you wear? A big sun hat.
A big sun hat at 2 a.m.
And a white dress and your white go-go boots.
Right. And you have a candle with you.
Well, I carry one wherever I go.
McDonald said that his shirt was pulled up over his hands and he used them to fend off the stabs. He was then knocked out in the hallway. When he woke up, the invaders were gone. He went to each room and tried to perform mouth to mouth. Then weakened, he went to his wife, pulled the knife out of her chest, put his pajama top over her, and called the MPs. MPs locked down the base and searched all cars for the described assailants until 6 a.m. that night. The murder weapons, a kitchen knife, an ice pick, and a 31-inch piece of lumber were found outside the back door. When shown the items, McDonald said he'd never seen them before, but police felt they'd come from the house and not been brought in by someone else. It would later be shown that the lumber was from the slats under one of the girls' beds. To give some background, Jeffrey McDonald was an Army Special Forces physician with the rank of captain at the time of the murders. He had met Colette in 8th grade and had a relationship with her until 9th grade when she broke up with him. In his sophomore year at Princeton, they started dating again. She was timid and he felt protective of her, hitchhiking to visit her at her own college. She became pregnant in 1963 and they got married a month later. He went on to finish his degree while Colette stayed home to take care of their daughter. She was taking night classes at one point. He enlisted in the Army June 28, 1969, following his medical internship. He would then volunteer to be a physician for the Green Berets. And oddly enough, he was prepared to go to Vietnam, but being a physician for the Green Berets, for whatever reason, meant you most likely weren't going to go overseas, which I was like, really?
That doesn't make sense.
But okay. Yeah. During all this time, including his internship, he was rarely home. You know, the internship, medical internships, take a lot of time. You're away from, you're there a lot. You're working super long shifts. Despite having 2 daughters at this point, again, he's gone. And once he enlisted in the Army, they sent him to different bases for training. He got paratrooper training at one place. He was trained in unarmed combat. So this was a man who should have known how to fight. Colette intended to go back to school to become a teacher, but she became pregnant with their 3rd child. She was 3 months pregnant with their 1st son when she was murdered. Their older daughter, Kimberly, was shy and smart, very feminine, Her baby sister was a tomboy and much more outgoing and willing to go toe-to-toe with others, especially those who went after Big Sister, which all of that, when they were describing them, made so much sense to me, the way mm-hmm. that the baby had so much overkill, because she got it worse than the older sibling. And they said she fought. She had defensive wounds in her hands. And she's two. I just bear that in mind. She's 2 years old. So the couple were well-liked. Neighbors said they sometimes argued, but nothing major. A teenage neighbor who babysat for them said they'd been weird to each other recently, describing them as indifferent. They really weren't talking to each other when she was around them. Upon further investigation, authorities puzzled over how a man trained in unarmed combat had left behind a living room with no damage other than a toppled coffee table and a single overturned plant. And later, there would actually be two of the people who responded, the first responders who took responsibility. One had knocked over the table, one had knocked over the plant. So supposedly he had this major battle with three men in his living room and nothing was offset. And he hardly had any wounds whatsoever.
Well, clearly he'd never watched a kung fu movie.
Clearly.
Obviously.
The shirt he said he'd used to defend himself in the living room had left absolutely zero fibers behind. Yet there were fibers from the shirt in all three rooms and beneath Colette's bed. They were in Kristen's bed. The same was true of wooden splinters from the piece of lumber. There were bloody splinters in all three bedrooms, nothing out in the living room or the hallway where he was apparently knocked out. In court later, he'd be like, well, I'm pretty sure what they hit me with was smooth. So I think they brought like a club or a baseball bat. And that's why there's not any fibers or any splinters. A fiber from his shirt was found under Kristen's fingernail and a bit of skin was found under Colette's fingernail. And it was collected, but it was lost before it could be tested. So there were some mistakes that came from the first responders. They also trampled. There's just so many people trampled through the scene before it was thoroughly investigated. The tip of a surgical glove was found under the headboard with Colette's blood on it. McDonald had a box of these in the kitchen. There were no fingerprints on the phones, even though he claimed to feel for a pulse and to have touched each of his family members before calling for help. There was also no blood on the phones, and his hands were clean. Finally, though it had been a rainy night, there were no fingerprints in the house or footprints in the house indicating someone had come in from outside with wet shoes on. A single bloody footprint from a bare foot was found in Kristen's room. Testing would later reveal it to be Colette's blood. When questioned, neighbors said they didn't hear screams for help or anything in the middle of the night, but they did hear Colette yelling angrily at one point. So they heard what sounded like a fight. With this information, the provost marshal called off the search for the intruders on February 23rd, no longer believing what McDonald had claimed happened. The rest of the case would come down to the forensic investigation. In fact, there was overwhelming forensic evidence showing Dr. McDonald as murderer. At the very least, it cast great doubt on his story. The shirt he'd been wearing had supposedly not gone into his daughter's room, but because he got into that fight in the living room, had it around his hands, and then so he wasn't supposed to have been wearing it, and he didn't carry it to all the rooms, he said. But Kimberly's blood was on the shirt. Colette's blood was, of course, all over the shirt. And Colette's blood was found in Kristen's room, like a good amount of it, not just a bit tracked in. Kimberly's blood and her brain serum were found in the doorway of the master bedroom, as if her attack had started there. She'd then been carried back to her room where the attack had continued. Jeffrey McDonald's blood was found in the kitchen adjacent to the cabinet where surgical gloves were kept and on a bathroom sink and nowhere else. Something that assisted. Yeah. But, you know, he got into this bloody fight in the living room.
Okay.
It hurts, doesn't it?
Aside here, just a momentary aside. Bathroom, the easiest place it is to stab yourself and clean up.
And you're exactly right. That's where he did it. It was just like down the side in the front of it. So something that assisted the investigation was the fact that each member of the family had a different blood type, which is considered a statistical anomaly, but not impossible. He or his wife, they had, one had A, one had B, then one of the daughters was AB and one of the daughters was O. Mm-hmm. So they were able to specifically know exactly whose blood was where. It was very helpful, actually, and it actually helped them reconstruct everything. So here's the reconstruction as the investigators saw it. Colette and Jeffrey got into a big fight in the master bedroom. He had been cheating on her, so it was assumed the fight might have been over that, but it could have been over anything, you know, married couple. Examining the evidence, it seemed like Colette had hit him with her hairbrush in the head because they found that hairbrush lying there, which is, he did have a mark on his forehead, but it hadn't broken the skin. He started punching her most likely and then found that piece of lumber, which he turned on her. It was thought that Kimberly might have heard the noises of violence and walked into their room, and she was hit with a piece of lumber in the doorway. They don't know if that was accidental or intentional, though, but once that had happened, it had escalated, right?
Well, yeah. If you saw somebody, even your husband, hit your daughter with a piece of lumber, you would probably lose your shit.
Yeah. So it was thought that Colette was likely unconscious at this point, possibly presumed dead by Jeffrey. So he picked his older daughter up and took her to the bed where he put her in there. And then he would finish everything later. It's thought that he killed her then with the lumber. And then afterward, he went into the baby's room and attacked her with the lumber. So this is when all the bludgeonings occurred, which were what actually really killed them. But Colette must have come to and run into the room. And it's thought that she threw herself over her daughter to protect her because her blood was found on the wall there and on the bed covers and everything. So it's thought that, That's probably why even more stabbings with little Kristen, because he started with her and then he ended up having to finish with her after he took care of Colette. He killed both of them with the lumber, they think. Then he wrapped his wife in one of his daughter's sheets and moved her into the master bedroom. And that sheet was in the master bedroom from the daughter's bed. And he didn't think, you know, to take it back or whatever. Desperate to cover up his crimes, he took the knives and the ice pick and went around to his daughters and stabbed them. He wrote pig on the headboard while wearing a glove. Then he put his pajama top on his wife's body and stabbed her through it with the ice pick. And later on, in one of the later cases, the forensic, you know, they would be saying that the wounds and the tears actually aligned. They had the photos from the crime scene. They put the shirt in the same way and they showed, yep, look at this. See, these cuts are exactly aligned, these holes. There were no like long jagged tears or anything like that. Like there would be had he had it wrapped around his hands, evading stabbings, right? He also had no wounds on his hands or arms. If they were stabbing him and he had been fighting it this way, they actually like tried it and the person trying it got cuts on their arms. So again,
and he probably had no bruising on his knuckles.
No, he did not.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
this is the person who watched CSI and thought he could stage a crime scene.
And the thing was, I'm like, just even as a doctor, I feel like he should have known something about even defensive wounds. Mm-hmm. He was an army doctor.
Put your arm through the mirror at least.
Something, do something. He didn't want to hurt himself too badly.
I guess.
Yes. Once this was finished, he cleaned the fingerprints off the murder weapons and threw them outside. He then grabbed a scalpel, went into the bathroom, and stabbed himself neatly between two ribs so that he would have he felt like that collapsed lung would be serious enough that it would be believable.
A scalpel wound is not a knife wound.
No, it's not. It would be so neat. And so, yeah, just
nice and very thin.
He wore surgical gloves, of course, throughout this process, and he disposed of them when he was done, which ensured his fingerprints weren't on anything. He then called the police with his clean hands and settled himself beside his wife. Of note, there was a pile of magazines that had been on top of the overturned coffee table. One of these was the March 1970 issue of Esquire, newly released, which covered the Manson family murders, which had occurred August 69 for at least the one. So the Sharon Tate murder. It hurts. The stupid hurts. So a delivery driver went to the investigators and said he knew of a blonde woman who was a police informant and drug addict who he felt had committed the murders. Her name was Helena Worley Stokely. Supposedly, she had worn black on the day of the funerals, and she was known to have outfits like what he described the woman wearing. And I'm like, oh, golly gee whiz. You mean in 1970, there were women with go-go boots and wide-brimmed hats? Yes, that's damning.
We know somebody who would wear that now.
Right.
I think I could find boxes like that up in my mom's attic.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not like it was a distinctive pattern or something. When she was questioned, she said that she had driven around that night with her boyfriend, yes, and that they were on mescaline, so she had no idea what she'd done. She had no memory. Others claim she had clothing like that. Witnesses stated that she might be responsible for the murders. You know, like they were just like, she totally has a wide brim hat like that. His final trial, there was so much here that I had to skip, you guys, because this is actually one of the most, this case has been tried more than like any other case, because it was first tried in the military courts and he was found innocent or whatever. And he got an honorable discharge and he went and hopped around till he did hump around. Actually, that was an apropos slip there, but he went to New York City. Then he went to Long Beach, California. He had a bunch of different jobs. He just kept moving up.
Did he write the book
or no.
somebody else? Okay.
No, that's it. I think I cut that out too, which is funny because again, this was 6 pages before I cut a bunch of stuff out. No, in 1970. So in the beginning, when he was dealing with the army stuff, he contacted this author and said, hey, I'd love to talk to you so you can write a book about my innocence. And so the guy, and unfortunately I deleted his name, but the book is called, it's what I call this. So the Fatal Vision is what the book is called. And it's something like Joe DiNuzzo or something like that. Yeah. But anyway, so the guy starts investigating and McDonald makes sure that he gets all of the stuff he needs for it. Yes, he has access, no problem. This guy's so cocky. And in the course of writing this book, which was meant to completely exonerate him, the author is like, this dude's guilty. And when he published the book, that's what it said. It said he was a narcissistic sociopath. And he was, by the way, like when you read about all of his appearances and stuff, because he started going on talk shows.
Of course.
He went on the Dick Cavett show.
Yes.
Yes. And he was so smarmy and so cocky and he was never sad or angry or upset or anything. He was always just like a robot when he talked about what had happened to them from the very beginning. So anyway, his final trial, this is in a civilian court, by the way. And this was after a huge long process in which his father-in-law, who had been Colette's stepfather, pursued the hell out of him, talked to the investigators, got all the evidence, multiple times had to file basically a civilian complaint and did finally get that approved. It went through appeals. And that's why it's 9 years later that this fucker actually goes to court. Okay.
Okay, good. We can use foul language.
We can. You are open to it.
Oh yeah.
That's right. I meant to tell you. We actually have like a
disclaimer.
Warning, a disclaimer in our intro that we add.
Good. By the way, this fucker describes him perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah. So along with a plethora of forensic evidence, which I kind of mentioned some of earlier, most damning of all was an audio recording of McDonald when he was first being questioned initially after the crimes, when again, completely indifferent. He's just, oh yeah. And then these guys came in and then, you know, I went in here and I gave my daughter mouth to mouth. And then I went in here and get, you know, like that's how he was relating it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they asked something that implied that he might've done it. And boy, he got pissed then. Then he had some emotions, very angry. Mm. Also, when questioned about his affairs, he simply said, oh, you guys are more thorough than I thought on the recording. It would later come out that he'd had more than 15 affairs during their marriage and that Colette had called her mom saying she knew of his affairs. She was miserable and she wanted to come home. And her mom had talked her into staying until spring. And 2 days after that phone call, they were dead.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like being the mom and living with that, not easy.
No. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, how? Yeah. She's got to be spending her whole life saying, what if I had just gone and picked my daughter up?
Right. Yeah.
Or just
come on home.
And here's the thing. Again, I deleted this out, but whatever, it's going to get said. I think it was 71. The mom got to about a year after the murder, she was diagnosed with breast cancer and she wasn't going to treat it. She just wanted to die.
I don't blame her.
No. But it was her husband who again was the stepfather of Colette who was just pushing so hard, because at first they supported Joffrey McDonald. They thought they were, of course, defending their son-in-law at first. Then they started seeing he was lying to them and he wouldn't let the dad see. He wanted the transcripts from the court case on the army base. And he evaded that. And then he said, no, me and my buddies went and we found one of the guys and we murdered him. We tortured him and murdered him. So it's okay. I'm working on it. And he told all these lies. And then they saw him on the Dick Cavett show and that was it. Oh. Then they publicly said, oh no, he killed our daughter and our granddaughters. And that's when his missions really started. Mm-hmm. So August 29th, 1979, after 6.5 hours of deliberation, the jury came back with a verdict of first degree murder for little Kristen, the one who was mostly brutalized, and 2 counts of second degree murder for Colette and Kimberly. The judge gave him 1 life sentence per murder to be served consecutively. July 29th, 1980, he was released from prison due to not having had his right to a speedy trial honored. And by the way, this is hugely shrinking down again, all of the appeals. He was let go at one point. It was turned back because of the speedy trial thing. And he goes out, the hospital gives him his job back. He gets engaged to a woman and announces it. It's funny. So he was engaged to a woman named Candy when they first went after him for that court case and he found out he was going to be tried again. And then when he got out briefly, he got engaged to a woman named Randy, spelled with an I, just in case anybody thought that he'd moved up from Candy. So anyway, then of course it keeps going through the court process, keeps going through appeals courts and Supreme Court and all this crap. I mean, there's so much. There's like 2 pages of all of the stuff about his court stuff. But anyway, finally, March 31st, 1982, it's determined his Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial had not in fact been violated. I mean, they were pulling that argument because it was 9 years later that he got tried in the civilian court and he was put back in prison. So appeals continued bouncing around for years. The last appeal was in 2018. Yeah. And you know, it's
not surprising.
Still there. So it's nowhere. Joe McGinnis. I did put the guy as the author who did that book. And McDonald did end up suing him once it came out that he was guilty. And they did actually settle out of court for $325,000. So then Colette's parents went after McDonald because there was something about an inheritance thing, yada, yada. So yeah. McDonald got to keep $50,000 of that and the rest went to the parents.
Was it the inheritance thing or the law that you cannot profit from a crime you've committed?
Yeah, I thought of that one, but they said it was about an inheritance. Yeah. Thing. So in 2002, he married a woman he'd known while free and not one of the ones he was engaged to. He'd actually known them before the murders, I believe. She'd written him to help while he was in prison, said, can I help with the legal stuff or anything? So anyway, she married a dude in prison. She's one of those. He's applied for parole multiple times, with the last being April 2021, which is what all those articles were about. I was finding for compassionate leave because his health is failing.
Well, good.
I know, but it was denied. Stokely died of cirrhosis. Stokely being the woman who was accused. There's a bunch more about her. She ended up coming in and being questioned in his regular civilian court case. And there's so much more to the investigation. At some point, apparently she confessed, but she maintained forever that she couldn't remember it. And so she had just thought that she did it or something, like, I must have done it, you know, after being accused and questioned enough times. And then her mom said, anyway, that's a whole bunch of stuff I cut out too. But
well, my mom was a hippie in the 60s and 70s, and there are many things she can't remember. Right. Well, I don't blame her.
But she ended up dying at 30 years old in 1983 of cirrhosis and pneumonia. She was found dead in her home. She'd been dead for 5 days. Her boyfriend, who she said she was driving around that night, died right before that. So, and Jeffrey McDonald not only outlived Stokely, but at least one of his judges, several of the involved attorneys, and his in-laws.
Like, this guy is like evil karma.
He is. They were going through when all these attorneys died and of what, and all the judges and what, you know, like, and just everybody died. And here is this cockroach still crouched in prison trying to get compassionate leave.
He needs to be covered with oozing boils.
Yeah. So before his father-in-law died, the man made a recording to be played at every parole hearing.
Good for him.
So they do. And, you know, he was like, I don't want him walking the streets ever again. For those interested in more in-depth information, there's a site dedicated to the case by family members called the Jeffrey MacDonald case. Stressing that because it's MacDonald.com. And it has, you can look at, they've got everything that they've gotten with FOIA. They've got documents if you want to look at them, all that good stuff. And of course, there's the book by Joe McGinnis called Fatal Vision. So you can check out more.
Why stuff is there. It called Fatal Vision?
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to read it probably. I know that. I just think it's so funny. It was like, yeah, this dude's going to write a book about me and he's going to say I'm innocent. And then, oh, he was so mad. That's the only time he ever showed emotion was anytime he was accused.
Like me thinking about my, you know, my training and education. Yeah. Forensics in the 70s was nothing like it is today. No DNA evidence, you know, very little wound pattern analysis.
Mm-hmm.
But dear Lord, this guy. So obvious.
It was so dumb. And yeah, again, it's obviously like this army dude trying to say what a hippie would be saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would tell you, I don't think my hippie mom has ever said pig ever.
Yeah, or kill the pig or acid is groovy.
I could ask her about acid is groovy.
Well, the thing that really bothered me that didn't really get brought up in all this, but when I first heard this story, I just remember being like, usually if somebody comes in to attack a family, the man is going to be the bigger threat. Mm-hmm. And therefore he is the one who's typically going to have the most physical, you know, the most physical fight and the most defensive wounds. Mm-hmm. And all that, because he is the threat and he has to be eliminated first.
I was going to say, and you would think he would be attacked first.
And he was in the living room adjacent to where, so they just mm-hmm. came in and walked right past him and managed to go on all three bedrooms and he slept through that. Yeah. So,
and if he was asleep, the easiest way to deal with that threat, if you're coming in to annihilate a family, is to just cut his throat.
Yeah, super easy. And by the way, Colette wasn't killed in her bed either. Yeah. I mean, and she was sleeping. She would have been in her bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not on the, in the middle of the floor in the master bedroom.
Or put a pillow over his head. I mean,
I know there's so many easy ways.
Easily
slit his throat.
I mean, and it wouldn't have been hard for him to even fake somebody trying to do that. Like if you put a bag over your own head long enough, you can create petechiae. You can have the proof that somebody tried to kill you.
Yeah. And he was
that doctor. In the 70s would have been known.
Yes.
He's a doctor. He
should have known how to make it believable. It blows my mind.
Here's this giant knife that I said they have, and here's my tiny little scalpel. Sorry, I'm going to be.
Well, in like that. The stab wounds on Colette, for example, just more stuff that I cut out because there was so much. It, mm-hmm. There was a kitchen knife out back and there was the paring knife stuck in her chest, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was clearly stabbed with the kitchen knife. They were all stabbed with the kitchen knife. The paring knife was not used. There's a distinctive difference in blades. There's a distinct difference in how deep though, you know, just, he was a dumbass.
Yeah. The bruising from the handle of the knife will leave evidence. Yeah. Oh my Lord.
Yeah. And yet, as stupid as he was, it took 9 years of him getting to live his life.
And be on Dick fucking Cavett.
And be on, Dick Cavett and all these other talk shows. And he contacted the media regularly, newspapers and stuff. Hey, I want to tell my side of the story. And he just thought he was smarter than everyone.
Clearly a narcissist.
Yes. That's the thing. Like they had a clinical psychologist come up and they were like, does he have a diagnosis? And they're like, no, not really. And I'm like, he's absolutely a narcissist. Stop.
Totally sociopathic.
Yes. I mean, it's so clear, but well, anyway, yeah, this guy, he's a special somebody. So
and maybe
definitely better die in
make his 2020. Or did he just have his 2021 since we're now in 2022?
Yeah.
May that hearing have gone as badly as I imagined it.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Especially when you use something like just, I know compassionate leave and what it means, but just nobody needs to have compassion for you, dude. You didn't have compassion for your 2-year-old baby who fought for her life.
As her mother was over the crib trying to defend her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So no.
No.
It doesn't happen.
No.
Oh, okay. So are you ready to tell your story?
I will. Would you like me to start with why this case is so personal for me, even though I had nothing to do with it? Like, yes. I didn't even know it happened until years later. So when I was working in forensic anthropology, I really wanted to do historical mummies and historical remains recreation. And there's really not that much work for that. And the big names in the field usually get it. So all of us grad students are given the bodies nobody else wants to work on. So I got a lot of very young murder victims, and I was about ready to drop out the first time when I learned about this case, and this case infuriated me. So whereas your case has somebody who is so obviously guilty, wandering around free for 9 years,
yeah,
my case has three people who are obviously innocent going to prison.
Perfect.
Like when I said that this case is damaged children all around, I'm not kidding. All the victims are children. It's the West Memphis Three, and it's a relatively famous case. I didn't learn about it until, I want to say, like 2002, because I know I had gotten my master's degree by the time I learned about the case, because I was literally on the edge of leaving. Anyway, so the West Memphis Three happened in West Memphis, Arkansas, of course. Let me pull up. I actually did get smart and do some notes on it. So on May 5, 1993, 3 8-year-old boys, Steve Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers, were reported from West Memphis, Arkansas. And my information on this is through varied sources, Wikipedia being one, Paradise Lost, the documentary about it being another, and multiple news articles, because it's actually recently just got back in the news with new DNA evidence. So just to give everybody my sources. But I've been aware of this case since the early 2000s.
Yeah.
The first report was made around 7 p.m. by Byers' adopted father, John Mark Byers, and the boys were allegedly last seen together by three neighbors, and they were playing together in the woods. The search began that night. Nobody located the children. By 8 a.m. the next morning, on May 6th, the police created an official search for the children, and they led the search along with the Crittenden County search and rescue personnel. They canvassed all of West Memphis, but focused primarily on the Robin Hood Hills where the boys had last been seen, and did a shoulder-to-shoulder, inch-by-inch grid search and did not find the children. 1:45 p.m., the juvenile parole officer, Steve Jones, spotted a shoe, and they then searched a ditch. And in the ditch were the children. They had been stripped naked, hogtied with their own shoelaces. They were lying on their backs with ligature marks and what appeared to be bite marks. And the clothing was mostly turned inside out, and two pairs of the underwear for the boys were never recovered. So clearly, the first assumption is a sexual assault. Christopher Byers had lacerations to various parts of his body and mutilation of his genitalia. The autopsy was performed by Frank J. Peretti and noted that Byers died of multiple injuries, and noted the bite marks, and that the children were both strangled and drowned. So it was like they were strangled, then drowned, then strangled, then drowned.
Mm-hmm.
Police, of course, initially suspected sexual assault. However, later testimony disputed this finding. Now, this is where I'm going to start to get really, really angry with this case, because this is where the investigation immediately gets bungled. So, the bite mark evidence. It was not photographed properly. It was not measured properly. And bite mark evidence is sketchy to begin with. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only reason anybody uses bite mark evidence is because of one case where Dahmer's teeth were just so unique that it actually worked. For the most part, it is more evidence of exclusion than evidence of support. So you can say, well, these teeth clearly do not match. However, because the evidence was so poorly maintained throughout this whole case, no one knows if it was animal predation or if it was actually human teeth.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, it gets worse. Of the three boys, Byers was the only victim with drugs in his system. And now remember, these are 8-year-old children.
Yeah.
And they had been missing for several days before they had been found. The initial autopsy describes the drug as carbamazepine and the dosage as subtherapeutic. It was possibly prescription medication that the child was already on. Okay, so just his medications. This is where I get I get to not start screaming. You understand, these are 3 8-year-old boys, Stephen, Christopher, and James. The community is in an uproar. It's a very conservative community with more churches than bars, just to talk in code here. If you get my drift.
Yeah.
So clearly something bad had happened to these children. They were immediately memorialized, and a memorial was put up in 1994. Then, if you're aware of the late 80s through the early 90s satanic panic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what happened here. Three teenagers, Baldwin, Eccles, and Miss Kelly, 16, 17, and 18 years old. So they were children who liked to listen to heavy metal, do weird things, and wear black clothes.
Clearly satanic.
Oh, clearly satanic. You know, Nickel or Echoes was an artist. He loved drawing really creepy crap, okay? So clearly these satanic children raped three boys, strangled them, drowned them, bit them, and sacrificed them to Satan.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Of course.
The evidence at this point, we have one forensic autopsy having been done. We have most of the evidence at the scene mislabeled, boxed somewhere, and kind of forgotten. And the entire community absolutely certain that these three teenagers did it. So, of course, the three teenagers did it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Of course. On top of this, Eccles' family was poor, couldn't afford to take care of, you know, their kid. They're going to get a public defender. One of the boys, I'm thinking it's McKelly, was special needs.
Mm-hmm.
He was not very intelligent. So they put the boys into hours and hours of interrogation until they broke him down. And he confessed to the crime, and he said what the sheriff and the prosecutor told him to say about how it happened, about what they did, and about how sorry he was.
Which has happened just time and time again.
Time and time again. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, there, of course, are other suspects. There's Chris Morgan and Brian Holland, who were fairly early suspects in the investigation. They were kind of pushed to the side. And then there was a suspect called Mr. Bojangles, a black man.
Of course.
Well, yeah.
Of course. Who was wandering around as a possible alternative suspect, because it can't possibly be any of the pillars of our community who did this, hanging around the Bojangles restaurant and watching small boys. I'm trying to kind of rush through all the details, because this is another case where there's appeals and there's bad evidence, and It's just a bloody mess. The police officers, James Sanberry and Steve Jones, felt that the crime had cult overtones and that the three boys clearly were the best suspects. So they ignored every other suspect they had. They boxed up, cataloged, and photographed the evidence badly, and they focused on the interview portion. They interviewed Eccles on May 7th, 2 days after the bodies were discovered. So clearly not really that much time for any forensic evidence to have been processed, you know? They zoomed in on these boys within days. On May 9th, during a formal interview by Detective Bryn Ridge, Eccles mentioned one of the victims had wounds up to the genitals. Law enforcement's view this knowledge as incriminating, ignoring the fact that the knowledge had been passed by the search and rescue crew.
And everybody
in town knew this by then.
Yeah, that's one of those
a month later,
that everybody talks about.
Yeah. You're not supposed to talk about certain details of a case.
Right.
A month later, June 3, the police interview brought Jesse Miss Kelly Jr., despite his reported IQ of 72.
Oh.
And his status as a minor, he was questioned alone without parents present. Miss Kelly's father gave permission for Miss Kelly to go with the police, but did not explicitly give permission for his son to be questioned or interrogated. He was questioned for 12 hours. until he was so upset and so scared of the police that he agreed to anything they said so that they would stop. He was not properly informed of his Miranda rights. He did not understand them, but they didn't care. They knew who did it. It was these three boys who wore black and listened to Metallica. As a fan of Metallica, now you can see why I decided to get out of historical forensic anthropology, because of this case. You guys have both met me. You know I listen to Metallica.
Right? So do I.
I was like, even I listen to Metallica, for God's sake.
8 months after the original confession, on February 17th, 1994, Miss Kelly made another statement to the police with his public defender, Dan Sidham, and it was advised not to say anything. But the boy could not understand to not cooperate. IQ 72. He ignored the advice and went on to detail how the boys were abused and murdered following the instructions of law enforcement. Yeah. The boys went to trial. The trials were held separately. Miss Kelly was separate from Eccles and Baldwin. They were all tried in 1994. Miss Kelly received a little bit lighter of a sentence. So during Miss Kelly's trial, Richard Ofsee, an expert on false confessions and police conversion, coercion. Can you tell I'm getting over COVID? And professor of sociology at UC Berkeley testified that the recording of his confession had all the earmarks of being coerced. That didn't matter. The confession was kept in entirety, and Ms. Kelly was required to restate it for the record, for the court record. And on February 5, 1994, Ms. Kelly was convicted by a jury of one count of first-degree murder, two counts of second-degree murder. The court sentenced him to life plus 40 years. His conviction was appealed, but the Arkansas Supreme Court reaffirmed the conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Eccles and Baldwin's trial was kept together. 3 weeks later, their entire trial basically rested on the fact that Ms. Kelly confessed and was convicted. The prosecution called Dale W. Griffiths, a graduate of an unaccredited Columbia Pacific University, as an expert in the occult to testify.
Oh, Lord.
That they were a satanic ritual.
Uh-huh.
On March 19th, 1994, Eccles and Baldwin were found guilty on three counts of murder. The court sentenced Eccles to death.
Wow.
And Baldwin to life in prison, no possibility of parole. Like I said, everybody here is a child victim. The defense team argued that the news articles and the local gossip was the source of knowledge for these boys. Yeah. It was everywhere.
Right.
Okay, so this investigation has been criticized from here to beyond and everywhere because it was so badly done. Evidence was mishandled. Photographs weren't taken. Eyewitness statements were taken months later, and coercion happened even in eyewitness statements. I mean, it is a crazy mess. The officials failed to drain the creek for any evidence to secure stuff. A fire apparently destroyed evidence. Oh, wait, no, it didn't, because just recently in the news, new evidence for the West Memphis 3 has just been found.
Mm-hmm.
Not destroyed by the fire. Right. The shoelaces that were the ligatures for the boys were found. And it took Damien Eccles, but who's alive, by the way? He did not die. It took his legal team months to appeal over and over again to get the evidence released, because there could be DNA evidence that could fully finally exonerate these boys. In 2007, Eccles petitioned for retrial based on the statute permitting post-conviction testing of DNA evidence due to technological advances made since 1994 to exonerate the wrongfully convicted, go me. However, I probably said committed because my daughter walked in behind me. I should be committed. However, the original trial judge David Burnett disallowed the presentation of this information to court. The ruling was in turn thrown out by the Arkansas Supreme Court to all three defendants on November 4th, 2010. So they went to jail in 1994. It's now 2010. Three innocent men, one of which is mentally disabled, rotting in prison. The adoptive father of Byers had a knife. The knife was possible evidence because DNA could have been found on it. Byers initially said, nope, the knife had never been used. This knife I own was new. It had never been used. But there was blood of the boys found on the knife. He then said, oh, well, maybe the boys were playing with the knife.
Question.
Yeah.
It's been a while. I am familiar with the story, but it's been a while. I always suspected that the dad, right? But
a lot of people suspected the stepfather.
Wasn't there more overkill on Byers? Wasn't there more?
He was the one who was like all three of the boys were tied, strangled, drowned. Byers is the one who had the damage to his genitalia.
Yeah.
However, because everything was flubbed, there's no proof of any sexual assault. There's no proof of any bite mark evidence. DNA samples were never taken from the bodies, like for saliva evidence.
I mean, when you have Satanists, then why should you investigate anything?
Seriously, you've got three boys listening to Metallica. What more do you need?
That says it all.
Which cracks me up because of all the, like, let's say hard rock or heavy metal there is. They're like the lightest.
Yeah. Anyway, so the knife had never been used. It was brand new. Oh, wait, no. Wait, my stepson's blood's on the knife. Well, he must have played with the knife. So he was a viable suspect, but nobody knows because the evidence was so badly mishandled that it only came out like a week or two ago. The shoelaces were finally released to Damian Eccles' legal team so they can finally do this DNA testing to see if there's DNA of somebody else on the shoelaces. Yeah. Anyway, the stepfather passed a polygraph test, and so that's good enough. Are they admissible in court? No. Are there ways to fool them? Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody can Google how to pass a polygraph test. Stick a tack in your through.
And now everyone knows.
This is why they're not admissible in court. Everybody knows that they are absolutely valuable. I mean, there are people who naturally pass them. Like, literally, when you tell them to lie, nothing changes.
Right.
Those are usually the sociopaths, like your case, Janet.
Right. Because if you're a sociopath, you're not going to have the biological reaction because you're indifferent. You know?
You don't care.
Pretty much. Okay. So 1996 and 1997, a forensic scientist actually looked at some of the pictures that were taken and said, well, these might be human teeth marks. So Eccles tried to appeal based on the fact that he had some serious periodontal disease. It didn't really work because by the time his appeal came through and everything could happen, he'd had most of his teeth removed.
Oh, yeah,
but he would have had a very distinctive bite pattern before because he was a poor kid in Arkansas who did not have good dental hygiene, did not have good dental care. So, of course, he would have had a very distinct, he would have been like a Ted Bundy bite mark.
Right.
He would have been up there. In 2003, one of the witnesses, Vicki Hutchinson, who had played into the arrest, you know, one of those ones who the police had said, hey, do this, recanted on her statement.
Huh.
Remember, I said 1994 to 2010, these guys are still in prison. 2007, new DNA evidence comes out. They're still in prison. Okay. Pamela Hobbs, in May 5 of 2009, declared that one of the hairs was consistent of a friend, David Jacoby, of one of the boys, one of the young boys. So an older friend who was like about like 13 or 14 at the time of the crime. A hair of another person was found because, oh, look, we opened an old Eccles West Memphis 3 box and we found more stuff that we didn't deal with properly to begin with.
Right.
2008, they found that the jury on the original trial had done misconduct.
Ugh.
Are these guys still in prison? Yes. It was revealed that Kent Arnold, the jury foreman of the Eccles-Baldwin trial, had discussed the case with an attorney prior to it. And he was not recused from the trial.
Oh, God.
Yeah, like I said, you had the idiot who did the worst cover-up in the history of cover-ups, and he walked free for 9 years. I've got, like, the Barney Fifes of police.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They listen to Metallica. They're guilty. So between 2007 and 2010, all three men requested for retrials multiple times. Most of the requests were denied. However, on September 10th, 2008, Court Circuit Judge David Burnett, who denied the request citing DNA tests inconclusive, that request was taken to the Arkansas Supreme Court on September 30th, 2010, and they were allowed to hear some new evidence. On November 4th, 2010, the Arkansas Supreme Court ordered a lower judge to consider the newly analyzed DNA evidence that might exonerate the three boys, by this time who are men.
Mm-hmm.
The justices also instructed a lower court to examine the claims of misconduct by the jurors, misconduct by the police force, misconduct by the prosecutor, and misconduct by the judge. Early December 2010, David Burnett was elected to the Arkansas State Senate. Circuit Court Judge David Lasseter was selected to replace David Burnett. Remember, this is the judge who screwed it all to begin with.
Uh-huh.
And he presided over the new evidentiary trials. In 2011, Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly were allowed to give Alford pleas. And do you know what an Alford plea is? The worst plea in the history of it. I still stand that I am innocent, but you have enough evidence to convict me.
Yeah.
They didn't have enough evidence, but this is what these three men who were in jail from 1994 were offered because of the misconduct.
God.
Under the deal, the convictions were vacated. However, they still had to carry the sentence, and the men were released. Judge Lasseter then sentenced them to a new sentence, time served, a total of 18 years and 78 days for Miss Kelly, and a total of 21 years for Baldwin and Eccles, and they were released.
They were released with...
Under an Alford plea with time served.
Yeah. But they're still murderers in society.
Yep. In the eyes of society, they are still convicted murderers.
Yeah.
Because they liked to wear black and listen to Metallica, and they happened to have the misfortune of living in Arkansas during the tail end of the Satanic Panic.
Yeah.
Or, you know, anytime.
Yeah. Many documentaries have been made about this case, even back as early as 1997, 98. There were documentaries being made that these guys were clearly innocent. I mean, Metallica actually agreed to have their music played in one of these documentaries, which is one of the first times they ever agreed to something like that. Because it was just so revoltingly obvious that everything had been stacked against these men. Damien Eccles is now an author, and he is a magician and does a whole bunch of other stuff. And he is still fighting for his innocence.
Yeah.
And I do not blame him at all. Really? I think the state of Arkansas owes him a huge...
Owes all three of them.
Oh, yeah. All three of them. I mean, seriously, you've got a guy who has the IQ of a child. Of literally the 8-year-old child.
Uh-huh.
You know, the children who were killed. And you use that to tell your story that these people who don't act, dress, and look like you are evil and deserve to go to jail.
And in the meantime, you leave at least one killer out in society to continue doing whatever they've done, because they've gotten away with it. So what would stop them from doing more?
Exactly. I mean, nobody knows who killed those three boys, because nobody's ever really looked at the evidence that survives. that's actually what the latest news on it is that Eccles really, really wants justice for the children. He wants to look at the DNA evidence. He wants to be him and his two friends at the time, because I don't know if they're friends anymore. I think this would probably have broken a friendship.
Probably not.
But he wants them to be declared innocent. And he wants the person who actually killed three children to pay for their crimes. Mm-hmm. Because somebody killed three children in 1993, and it's 2022, and they're still free.
Yeah. And again, I've already said who I suspect, but it's yeah.
I have suspected him for years.
Yeah. I feel like this is one of this is one of the first things you're supposed to look at, is one of the victims clearly intended to have been the major recipient.
We see
that one of them clearly was, even though they didn't take the evidence well enough to be able to prove that, but that's who you look at. That's who you track to see who in this person's life, mm-hmm. who in this little boy's life, the little boy that took the most punishment out of all of them, who clearly the attack was focused on, who in their life might have done this, and they didn't even bother doing that. And I get, not so long ago, though, that they didn't already have an understanding of that principle.
This is like, literally, this case is one of the reasons why I did agree to go into criminal forensic anthropology. It's one of the reasons why you will get me screaming about stranger danger. Because everybody who knows anything about forensics or investigation knows. You look at the first person who reports a crime.
Uh-huh.
Who was the first person? Oh, the stepfather.
Uh-huh.
He's the one who reported those boys missing. You look at immediate close friends and family first. Oh, the stepfather. You look at somebody who had a grudge. Oh, the stepfather. You look at the damage done to the victims. Who received the most damage?
The stepchild.
Stepchild. And then the damn knife.
Yeah, it's just, it's mind-blowing. It actually could have been a pretty simple case had it been investigated well and thoroughly. Mm-hmm. It could have mm-hmm. been.
Or, you know, at all.
At all.
At all. At all. Yeah, exactly. At all. I mean, now, you know, like when you asked me to come and do this, why I said this is the case that changed everything for me, even though I didn't know about it at the time. It just, everything that could have been done wrong was done wrong. Every bias that could have existed, existed. And the stepfather was a good, God-fearing man.
Right. So it couldn't be him.
Pillar of the community, man.
So was John Wayne Gacy.
Seriously.
Yeah.
The BTK killer.
Yeah. I'm doing the Central Park Five, and there's so many parallels, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Absolutely. Where, again, a set of children was victimized in addition to the original victims. It's so frustrating. And they've shown repeatedly now that youths, we'll say the youths are always going to be vulnerable to police coercion. And police, you question minors without their parents present. They're looking at you as a form of authority who they have been mm-hmm. trained through their lives.
Yeah.
Authority, authority, authority. You do what they say. You don't give them food and water. You question them for 12 freaking hours. Of course they're going to say they're guilty. They don't think they're getting out if they don't say they're guilty. They don't think, okay. And their children.
Children.
About the future consequences.
So Miss Kelly was, you know, yeah. Okay. So he was 18 at the time. Still a child. Their brains are not completely formed. They only have a complete emotional center. Their logical center is not fully connected yet.
No.
So of course they're going to respond with fear and the desire to please. And this is why children get children's advocates who are trained to work with children.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frustrating.
This is the case for me. Yeah. This is the one.
It's just amazing that basically American society in general has been pretty convinced that these boys were innocent if not from the beginning, close to, and yet no justice seen, you know, and even the bit of justice that they've gotten now is not, true justice.
No, I mean, an Alford plea is the worst thing you can do to yourself because you are not being released. You are not being declared innocent. What you're saying is, in the eyes of the law, I am guilty, and I agree that they were right to hold me in prison for nearly two decades. I agree that they were right to do this to me. You give up all your rights when you sign an Alford plea. And that's probably why they had them do it.
Right. They're like, we're not going to admit that we're wrong, but I guess we'll get you out of prison.
Yeah, we'll let you go before we have people literally picketing our, you know, Capitol building.
It's gross. Yeah. Serious miscarriage of justice.
Serious. I mean, literally. Oh, the evidence box is burned in a fire. Oh, oops. Psych. They didn't.
Oh, look, there's that box right there with all the evidence in it.
Oh, but we're not going to give it to you because it's not our job as the prosecution to make sure you have access to everything you need to do a defense. Oh, wait, it is.
Oh, yeah. Wait, that is actually like, legally my job.
And it sounds like a box, like I'm envisioning a banker's box that's in the corner right under the stairs. It's gotten damp. Everything is just shoved in it.
I'm envisioning one down in the basement of the former prosecutor's house at this point.
Yeah.
What happened to that box of evidence?
Gosh,
and that's the other thing. Like, for me, like, you've heard me talk about the types of evidence and how important chain of evidence is. It's like, okay, now how many different ways can the real killer claim that nothing can be
admitted.
Admitted in court because the chain of evidence was so badly broken.
Right. Even whatever they get now, there's so many arguments against it. And then I could see the McDonald argument, which is also right to a speedy trial. There's
I mean, luckily, because it would be a new trial in a murder case where there is no statute of limitations, McDonald argument usually doesn't apply. However, you know, whoever did it, and we all know who we think did it, has plenty of money to fight this. And they're going to bring out every argument. And yeah, all it takes is one person opening that box. Like, seriously, if you had that box, say it was, okay, so let's give them the benefit, a little slight benefit of a doubt. Say the box was in the police department, in some corner, under a stair in the basement. And you had one janitor pop the top.
Yeah.
That's all it takes. One seal broken without initials on it. That's all it takes.
Yeah, it's just terminally bad from the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, all right, MB. Are you ready?
I am ready. So I'm going to...
This one's a little lighter.
This one's a little... Well, it's lighter... compared to these two. Nobody's
oh, good.
Okay. And this is not involving, moms and daughters.
Okay.
Or moms and a daughter. So I classify this as mayhem, but you could also call it monster.
Okay.
My sources were Newser, Facebook, KY3, which is a...
not a lube.
Not a lube. I was like, seriously, you choose to go by KY3. It's like super lube.
Wait, somebody's going by KY3.
It's a news station. It's a television station. The New York Times, the U.S. Department of Justice, and Market Watch. Why this was on Market Watch, I have no idea. And I'm betting when I start talking about this, a lot of people are going to go, yeah, I heard something about that. Because this got picked up, she just got sentenced. The woman I'm going to talk about just got sentenced. And so it got picked up for all the wrong reasons. Because I heard it on the radio, on the morning show, the most vapid morning show in existence. But, and we all know that mothers and daughters can have strange or complicated or messy or just plain fucked up relationships.
Sure.
So this one doesn't just take the cake. It takes the cake stand, and the table that it was sitting on. This story went public from Mountain View, Missouri in 2018. So it's also relatively recent for me. There are no hatchets. I know.
She always does like turn of the century hatchet murders and stuff.
I did that one set in what, Germany? And yeah. The werewolf. And I was
the book about the murders. So
when you're done, then I will tell you about my favorite hatchet murder, but continue. Okay.
So it's 2018. Detective Stetson Schween. His first name is Stetson. I mean, God bless him. It was law enforcement or a life of crime. He really had to pick one of the two.
Really, that was your stopper? Because Schween was my stopper, but I am from a Wayne's World.
Okay. I'm pronouncing
it. Oh, might be.
Well, I'm thinking with Stetson Schween, more like an exotic male dancer.
Right.
Anyhow, he gets a phone call. Oh, it links to yours because it has an Arkansas connection. He gets a phone call from the police in Jonesboro, Arkansas. So it wasn't West Memphis. But they're searching for a woman named Laura Oglesby, who has a U.S. bench warrant for identity fraud. So involving fraudulent use of company credit cards. What happened was she was working for an auto body shop in 2014 and stole $28,000 by having 6 credit cards fraudulently issued to her from company accounts. I don't know. I'm thinking she's got some smarts that I don't think everybody could do that. I mean, I know there are some places that are very trusting and it wouldn't be that difficult. So, okay, she's embezzling funds, but that's not the strange part. This is where the story takes, as I call it, a hard left into what the fuckville.
Sorry, my reaction.
Arkansas with her estranged daughter's birth certificate and went to Missouri and uses the birth certificate to get a social security card issued fraudulently. I could just use the word fraudulently in every sentence and it would be completely accurate. So then she uses the social security card. She goes down, she gets a driver's license. I mean, she has to take the driver's exam, the whole nine yards. This is a 40-year-old woman, 40-ish.
How old is the daughter?
Like, when she got the driver's license, she had to have been like 18 or 19.
So she's passing herself off as a teenager.
Yes. So, as Lauren Hayes, she got work at the Mountain View Public Library, where she was a general aide and like did story time reading to the children. She claimed to come from an abusive background, and I do not want to say that she didn't. It's really hard to find background information on her.
Okay.
At one point, she was actually living in a battered women's shelter, and somebody who worked there came to this couple and said, we have this woman, you know, she's in her early 20s and she needs a fresh start. So they took her into their home and were mentoring her and, you know, trying to help her get started in life. They didn't realize this was her second time around. They started to get suspicious and were making phone calls because one of them had a relative in the town that she said she came from when everything blew up. So the Jonesboro police had called the Mountain View, Missouri police, and they picked her up on a traffic stop. And at first she denied, I'm really Lauren. And they said, well, we have all this proof that you're not. And she's like, well, okay, I'm not. But she immediately caved when they confronted her. So she got federal assistance to attend Southwest Baptist University. She had completely adopted the lifestyle of a 20-something. So she had her hair done in a very youthful, I saw some of the pictures.
I could get my hair done in a very, being about the same age as this woman.
You guys see the amount of gray here? I'm not going to pass.
But she had, she wore a lot of makeup. So it kind of covered some stuff up and she acted like a 20-something. So here's what really killed me. I'm going to read this because the Mountain View Police Department posted this on Facebook. This was in August On August 30th of 2018, the Mountain View Police Department has arrested Laura Oglesby, age 45, of Willow Springs for bench warrants out of Arkansas for financial fraud and for embezzlement of over $25,000. Laura Oglesby stole and assumed the identity of a 24-year-old female named Lauren Ashley Hayes and worked in Mountain View for over a year. Within that time, she has obtained lines of credit, obtained funds from multiple colleges, and a driver's license, which she used under the name of Lauren Hayes. We are currently collecting information on any transactions financially under the name of Lauren Hayes. She has committed this identity fraud over the last 2 years. If you have any information, please contact, and it gives the detective's name and his phone number. More charges are pending. What I thought was interesting was one of the, so I had to read some of the comments on Facebook. I mean, come on.
You gotta read, yes.
That's better than some of the novels I've read. But one of the people knew her in a previous life and said, I came on Facebook because I remember when she went missing and her husband was posting all over Facebook, was posting pictures of her to say, has anybody seen her? But I could not wait.
So she went missing.
Uh-huh.
Became her daughter. Lived as a 20-year-old.
Uh-huh.
Went on Facebook.
And she was all over Facebook and Instagram.
And she's not realizing that somebody somewhere is going to figure out she's not a 20-year-old.
Yeah. So she was completely into this. And yet, when you look at the photos, in some of the photos, because there's a ton of them.
I pulled them up.
Yeah. And some of them, you can say, okay, she does look younger than she is. But there's one where she's wearing little rhinestone cat ears where you're like, no fucking way. That woman is 21 years old or 22 years old. But this is the age of filters.
Yeah, she's really good at the Snapchat filter. She's really good at it.
And she's got the little, where she's got the little kitten face, a little cat nose and all kinds of stuff. Even the guys she dated, she was dating college guys.
Oh, gosh.
And they thought she was 22 years old.
Well, they're fucking stupid. Whatever.
Right? However, I would like to point out, nobody is making a fuss that a 45-year-old woman was dating 20-year-old men. But if the situation were reversed and it was a 45-year-old man who went to college and was dating 20-year-old co-eds, people would be coming out in droves with pitchforks, setting him on fire. But it was doing it, so that was okay. So I'm like, where was I? Yeah, she still claims that she was in an abusive relationship for years and did all of this to stay hidden. But I'm like, but you don't post yourself, you don't plaster social media with your picture with your own daughter's name if you're trying to stay hidden.
Yeah. No, you don't.
Savvy doesn't mean, like, sly doesn't always equate to smart.
Yes, exactly. So the reason, so this was all over the place in just like a month or two ago, because in December of 2021, at the age of 48, she pled guilty to one count of intentionally furnishing false information to the Social Security Administration. And under the terms of her plea agreement, she has to make restitution in the amount of over $17,000 to Southern Baptist University, as well as restitution to the victim, who is her daughter.
Right.
So I can't tell. It looks like sentencing hasn't happened yet, but she could serve up to 5 years in prison.
I'm totally okay with that, actually.
I'm like, I can't even imagine. I mean, it's just the fucking your own daughter over to that extent. Your own child. I mean,
okay, earlier we're all moms here.
Right.
We got some people who should have been required to take parenting classes before being allowed to have any. So I can't find any, what I couldn't find was, I couldn't find any interviews with her. Why did you do this? What was your, you know, what was going through your head when this was going on? There's also, what I found really interesting was there's nothing from her estranged family. Now, I do understand that her daughter, I can understand her media absence because she is a victim and she deserves a right to privacy.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
If she doesn't want to talk about it, she doesn't have to. But what I can't understand why is, I mean, there were, this hit the United Kingdom. There were articles in fucking India about this woman. I can't believe that nobody has come forward and said, I grew up with that bitch and she was crazy. Or, oh my God, I went to church school with her and she was the nicest, sweetest person, or her estranged husband or an old neighbor. It's like there, it's complete isolation. There's just the incident and there's nothing around it. I can't believe nobody's writing a book about it. I can't believe nobody, you know how
there's not already a docuseries.
Right. Because they do have some interviews with that couple I mentioned who took her in. But it's very short. It's very like, yes, we totally believed her. By the time we started to question her, that was when everything blew up. I, you know how people are, when there is an accident, people stop and rubberneck. Yeah. And people all want to claim, and we've talked about this in the past, they all want to claim they knew the murder victim, or they were best friends with the murder victim's sister, or whatever. And nobody is making that claim on this.
They're like, I'm just not going to touch this.
They're like, nah, she cray cray. I'm not going near that.
I'm thinking she has got to be like, everybody in her hometown's like, okay, you all remember what she was like in high school. Let's just all drop it. This woman will cray.
And I'm like, and what if she did? Not that it excuses it, but it's entirely possible that she did come from an abusive background. But I don't know if who knows? That's what always drives me crazy.
I think they're all embarrassed because all the people who didn't figure out that she was 45 are embarrassed.
I can't believe anybody who saw her naked, because you can generally tell there's tells that a woman has given birth.
Oh yeah.
You know,
maybe that's what she spent the money she stole from like the auto place on, was all the plastic surgery to appear to be on her tummy. Right.
You know, it didn't mention any surgery, but that could be. I mean, you know, in some pretty private places. Yeah. I remember reading once, I can't remember what author said this, but he was like, I don't even remember if it was male or female. They said that after you've given birth, they said that you can tell on a woman at a glance because your navel never looks the same after you've given birth. Her like has a little lip or a little divot or something.
I don't think I paid that much attention to my navel before.
I didn't either. So
you can tell with a woman's pelvis if she's given birth.
Yes,
absolutely.
But I always want to know why. I always want to know what, you know, was she fleeing an abusive husband? And if so, why?
Nah, I'm hitting like a midlife crisis right now about my appearance, because with all the shit I've been dealt with the last couple of years, I've finally started showing signs of aging. That I was aging pretty fucking well, okay? And then and so I'm like having this personal appearance crisis right now. So that's what happened to her. She was like, she found a wrinkle, and she was like, oh. That's it. I need to steal my daughter.
If I find a wrinkle, I don't like.
If it's a full sister or a half sister or a step, but there was a photo that was mom and the daughter and it said it was Laura and Lauren and Lauren's sister. And I'm like, well, wouldn't that also be her daughter?
Yeah.
And I'm like, if she had two daughters, I'm like, well, how do you pick which one you're going to fuck over?
The oldest?
The one whose birth certificate you have handiest?
Yeah, either the oldest or the one you look the most like. I'm looking at this photo, and it looks like she snagged the ID of the kid she looked the most alike, because it looks like the other one's older.
Makes sense. Okay. So, yeah. That would certainly, I have four siblings, and we all are varying degrees of different, so yeah. I could see a parent.
Yeah. I don't think I'd be able to take my kid's ID. I don't look enough like her.
I couldn't take either of my children's IDs. First of all, they're 22 and almost 25. And they look radically
different. Well, one of mine is a son. So that automatically complicates things. My daughter is blonde, so yeah. I'd have to.
You'd have to. My hair. Yeah, mine is 16, so.
And there's a 30-year difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if there was only 20 years difference between you and your kids, it would be more feasible than, you know, I was 33 and 35 when I had my kids. So
yeah, I was
even then I couldn't have passed for 20. So.
Like 28 and 30 and 31. So
yeah, I was 27. So no way.
Yeah,
no
you have 18. You can. Yeah, there's a much better chance. How I'm at 16, even better chance. Like that doesn't happen a lot.
There. Nobody whose gene pool I wanted to perpetuate when I was 16.
Yeah, same.
Tell us about your favorite hatchet murder.
Yes.
Okay, so it's a weird one because no one's even sure if it's true or not. But this is just like, okay, so have you ever read Pioneer Girl?
I don't.
Pioneer Girl? The
autobiography of Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Oh,
no.
So before she wrote the Little House series, she actually wrote a novel, which was an autobiography. And some people called it a novel. Some people called it a biography because it really was her life. And it was written from a more adult perspective. And it actually has all the missing years in it because when she was in Lake Pepin, Wisconsin, she was actually only two. And in the Little House series, she moves her age to four. Mm-hmm. And she actually deletes several years from her life. One of the years she deletes from her life in the Little House series that you only get a very mention of when Pa comes back with the glass for their house because Pa's an idiot. And why does a Saudi need glass? But when he apparently stayed at an inn and it was in Kansas. And let me see if I can remember the name of the serial killer couple.
I just talked about serial killer couples in Kansas. Was it the Bloody Benders?
Yes, the Bloody Benders. Thank you. I was like, Laura Ingalls Wilder. They show up in Pioneer Girl.
Oh.
Apparently, Laura remembers she was quite young at the time. And Pa told the story, and Pa wasn't really good about always telling the truth.
You know, I think I remember hearing that he mentions like, this.
Yeah, that so apparently the Bloody Benders, like when Laura was in Kansas in the 1870s, Pa and a bunch of people find out the Benders are killing people, and so they like run them out of town on a rail and then murder them. And people are arguing whether or not this actually happened, but it shows up in both Pioneer Girl and in the Little House, although in the Little House, it's much subtler. In the Little House, he doesn't really talk about it. But yeah, it's one of my favorite because it's like, did she actually, did Pa Ingalls kill the Bloody Bender?
Actually, nobody knows what happened to the Bender.
Yeah, no one knows.
Awesome.
I know. So it's one of my favorite. And for years afterward, they would, if a woman and if two women were traveling together who looked like mother, daughter of the right age, they were arrested.
Yep.
As the Bender mom and daughter.
Yep. Well, you know, there's a bunch of the serial killers of the 1800s that just kind of vanished. Like Guinness, like some people think she died in the fire. Some people think she ended up in California. Mm-hmm. No one knows. Yeah, I like those old ones. So yes, I like the hatchet murders too.
Yes.
I'm going to have to read Pioneer Girl. I never read the books, but I of course grew up on the show. Michael.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. And so I still have even vague memories of watching that show. I was little enough, but that I can't remember it concretely, but I remember enough about it. But
I think people should read Pioneer Girl because it's written like, it's written from an adult perspective. She wrote it, like she wrote everything as an adult, but she wrote Pioneer Girl first. And then she ended up writing the Little House series and breaking into more child's fiction, you know, because a lot of people didn't realize they were true stories until years later. The other one is Rose, her daughter wrote a book about Manny and Laura's life and what the government did to these settlers who were going out to get the free land and how they're basically using people. And that one's called Freeland. And a lot of people don't know that one exists either.
Not our government.
No.
Our government. What it actually, it even goes into how evil the railroads were.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, yes. Okay. Thank you for coming on. And thank you to everybody for listening.
Yes.
And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Mysteries, Monsters, and Mayhem.
Find us on Facebook and Instagram or at our website, mysteriesmonstersmayhem.com.
Please like, rate, and review, follow, and share wherever your favorite podcasts are downloaded.
Thank you for listening and supporting our podcast. We'll be back next week with more shenanigans.